is the Monday Mindset Podcast, where we share things of interest to us and hopefully to you.
So let's get started with episode number 81. And this week it's Terry's turn to share something exciting with us. What have you got for us today, Terry?
Well, Daisy, I'm going to share something from a podcast that listeners may recall me sharing from before, and that is Being Well with Dr. Rick Hansen and his son, Forrest Hansen. It's probably no surprise I like listening to them because it's a psychologist talking about psychology, and it's always interesting to me. But this topic is especially interesting because it's something that I read a lot about, listen to a lot of podcasts about, and still struggle with in my own life. The episode is episode 170, and it's called Avoidance, How to Stop Procrastination and Worry.
I'm going to find that interesting for sure.
Yeah. And I hope listeners will hear some things in here that might be useful to them. So in talking about avoidance, first, Rick Hansen talked about just kind of understanding it's a natural human response that we are really driven in our behavior to approach pleasure and to avoid pain. But sometimes this gets a little confusing because sometimes avoiding pain doesn't really look like you're approaching pleasure, but the pleasure is simply not experiencing the pain. So another way to think about it as promotion, meaning growing something, creating something, or prevention, minimizing or diminishing something. He also then talked about a third way to think about avoidance, but acknowledged that he wasn't going to go into much detail about that. He talked about this especially because so much of the theory and practice of psychology has been based on the work of men. And he acknowledged in this episode, they were both two men talking about this topic, and that it may actually look a little different for women as women are socialized a little differently.
Interesting.
And that is that avoidance can be stemming from abiding in connection with or resting in relationship with. So some behaviors that may be deemed as avoidance really might be a strategy of connecting and maintaining relationship. So they just made note of that. So they talked about avoidance generally looks like some behaviors that we're all familiar with, procrastination, maybe using passive aggressive language, obsessive rumination, or by limiting situations that you engage in. And in general, just the idea that it is intended to avoid the stress of an experience, an emotion, of an interaction. And I think an important framework for all of us to use, and then we'll learn more about this later in the episode, but that avoiding things is a form of coping. Approaching things can also be a form of coping. So for example, stopping at a red light to avoid an accident, that's healthy coping. So in this example, it wouldn't be bad for someone to use avoidance. Yes, you want to avoid a car accident. But let's say, for example, you avoid getting into your car because you hold a lot of fear about interacting with people and social situations. That then would become an unhealthy avoidance. So again, approaching can be a form of coping and avoiding can be a form of coping depending on what the situation is. Forrest, the younger gentleman in the podcast, talked about one of the challenges of avoidance is that it actually makes longer-term effects of a stressor worse. By avoiding something and putting it off, we obviously are not wanting to face the stressor. We're prolonging that time until we have to face the stressor. But unfortunately, what usually occurs is that it actually makes the whole impact worse. It increases both the length and intensity of the stressor. So it drags out the stressor. And oftentimes, one of the reasons why we talk so much about avoidance and procrastination is that it starts to spiral more out of control. And the consequences kind of stack up on themselves. And eventually the person totally wants to avoid this situation, even though they still have to face it. So this is why they spent time talking about avoidance. Rick Hansen at some point made a good point about this and acknowledged that avoidance is not just an overall pattern, that we may have more or less capacity to manage certain stressors at certain times in our development, certain times in our life, and that we shouldn't necessarily then just judge our avoidance as a negative thing. And we may find even one person's avoidance, someone else can manage it very differently at that same time. So when we are avoiding, we are less engaged and we're stuck in an older view of ourselves. So often it's a limiting belief, like I can't do this. I'm uncomfortable when I go into public and so we avoid it. But one of the reasons why it's so bad for us is that it doesn't allow us to learn differently. It doesn't allow us to replace those old thoughts of ourselves and the world with better ones. So it cuts ourselves off from that opportunity. They then went ahead and talked about categories of avoidance situations or reasons why we avoid. The first one talked about phobias. Dr. Rick Hansen talked a little bit about a client that he had worked with many years ago, a little girl who was phobic about grass. And that phobia prevented her from doing a lot of things. So those are probably pretty obvious avoidance situations. But they then talked about a category called protective avoidance. And this would be our rumination, our obsessive thoughts or feelings, focusing on the bad things that could happen. And it's called protective avoidance because in general, we think that it helps us hold off the negative consequence of the stressor. So we spend a lot of time worrying about something. And again, if you've done this before, if you ask someone before, like, why are you worrying about that? You can't control that. Somehow the belief is that if I put energy into worrying about it, it won't hurt so bad when it happens. It won't bother me so much if I'm kind of prepared. So again, this is why it's referred to as protective avoidance. Unfortunately, again, it actually keeps the underlying feelings or longings at bay. And what we actually need to learn in these situations is how to tolerate them better, not how to avoid them, because we're causing ourselves a lot of pain in the waiting. And then they talked about substitution avoidance. And this would be an example of expressing one emotion rather than one that feels more difficult. And the most common that people talk about with this, I would think, would be anger. That it feels a lot easier for many people, not everyone, to express anger than feelings that are a little more vulnerable, like hurt or sad. And so because the underlying emotion actually is very uncomfortable to tolerate, people will switch over to this other emotion instead because it feels a little easier to tolerate. And then Rick Hansen added another example of substitution avoidance would be problematic eating. If I'm feeling lonely, sad, scared, bored, angry, eating to kind of block that emotional experience obviously is a type of avoidance. So I thought that was relevant to conversations that you and I have pretty regularly. So in thinking about then what to do about avoidance, everything I'm going to say in some way comes back to the main theme of this is that the question to ask yourself about your own avoidance or to help someone else work on their avoidance is to keep focusing on what is the function of the avoidance. And in this way, recognizing it's not a bad behavior. It's not a horrible coping mechanism. It is a way that we've learned to lessen our stress about something. And you may be familiar with this term, but secondary gains. So by avoiding something, I'm making a situation worse, but the secondary gain is I don't have to face it yet. So there's always kind of an underlying motivation, even if the avoidance itself creates a negative outcome. it is intended for a positive reason. And so to think about it that way, to not pathologize ourselves so much. Yeah, I'm doing this problematic behavior, but I'm doing it because I think it's protecting me, or it's been a learned coping strategy for many years. So follow the path of what the avoidance is achieving, and then ask what it could mean if you approached it. So for example, a week or so ago, I was traveling for a weekend, and I had to clear some space for some workers to come into my apartment and do some work. And I was stressing about getting the place straightened up so they could come in and doing all of this stuff. And someone helped me walk through, well, what will it look like if you don't do it? And what would it look like if you did it? And my usual approach is I will wait until the last minute. I'll stay up until 2 a.m. boxing things up. And they said, well, what would it be like if you boxed it up before 9 p.m.? And of course, I had all these reasons why I would wait and why my pattern is that I wait until the end, the last minute. And just being able to walk through what would it look like to approach it instead of avoiding it, and help me to recognize, wow, that would feel nice if I was done at 9 p.m. I might actually get sleep before I travel. So again, looking at what is the function of the avoidance? What is it that you're actually trying to avoid? What discomfort? And then to explore what could it mean to approach it. So Forrest Hansen talked about the idea that oftentimes we get some bodily sensations that give us cues about what we're avoiding or a feeling that we're trying to avoid. He used the example that your heart rate increases and your breath rate increases. The thing is, until you interpret this, you don't really know what that somatic sensation means. Does it mean you're excited or does it mean you're scared? Because they both can cause those same bodily sensations. So when we become aware of our body responding, this might signal to us that that emotion is coming, that uncomfortable emotion is coming. And then this is why we jump into avoidance mode, because we don't want to experience that emotion. Unfortunately, though, this usually backfires on us in different ways. But one, I think this is an important concept to think about. The benefit of avoidance that we think we're getting from it are often far exceeded by the cost of it. And this quote really stood out to me because I have it all set up in my brain why my avoidance is a good thing. Why waiting until the last minute to do something makes more sense? Why would I do it early when I don't have to be under that stress until the last minute? But in essence, I've been under that stress the whole time then. So again, the perceived benefit of avoidance is often far exceeded by the cost of it, because it can set us up for a prolonged experience of that stress or a worse possible outcome. So one of their suggestions is to practice relaxing into the fear and allow it to flow through you, not to become overwhelmed by it, but to just recognize, I'm afraid of being judged if I do that. Let's say, for example, you're experiencing some social anxiety about going to a party where you're going to interact with other people, but you really want to have more social connections, that you have to be willing to face that. So letting the fear just kind of flow through you, observe it, and recognize that it's not so overwhelming as what you've made it out to be in your mind is one thing that they talk about. Okay, so how do we work through our avoidance? First, the topic that I already talked about, recognizing the secondary gain, recognizing what do I perceive, how am I actually benefiting from this? And then recognize that that isn't serving me as well as I would hope. They also talked about joining the defense. And this is a psychological term. I don't even remember what theory this comes from, but basically it's normalizing it. So letting yourself know or someone else who is avoiding, you know, letting them know, it makes sense that you would want to avoid that. I understand that that's difficult for you, rather than, you know, maybe yelling at yourself or blaming yourself or telling someone else they're stupid for thinking that. And then to maybe ask or explore with them or with yourself, What is helpful about it? What do you like about it? What do you like about not taking your car for an oil change? So it's in a way kind of helping them to own, I'm doing this by choice. And what are the payoffs or benefits? And by having them kind of think through this or having yourself think through this, you can start to own it and take responsibility for the choice. And I think this is really important. Also then breaking it down into taking steps toward not avoiding. What if I did the thing? What if I took my car in for an oil change? Well, I'd have to wait for a while they're changing the oil. I guess I could listen to an audiobook or something. Well, if I got it done, then I wouldn't have to worry about that light going off in my car. So we could just walk through what would it mean if you did do the activity. And then Forrest talked about going another step forward with this is then breaking down the effort into a small amount of time, committing to small bits. So for example, if you say, hey, I would like to meditate more, that you don't commit to start with, I'm going to meditate 45 minutes every day. But you might start with, I'm going to meditate for 2 minutes every day. Start with a small commitment rather than avoiding the big commitment. He also talked then about anticipating obstacles and ways that you might cope with them. And it reminded me of what you had talked about. And a common theme in a lot of this is that by mentally rehearsing outcomes that we might want to avoid, we can give ourselves the opportunity to visualize how we would cope with something or recover from something. I think you talked about that in our recent Keto Woman podcast that we recorded. Mm-hmm. So I think this is important, recognizing there may be some obstacles to this thing that I'm avoiding, and that's okay because I can handle them. And then Rick Hansen, the psychologist, talked about looking at yourself as someone who can cope, looking at yourself as a coper. And he used this analogy, and I've never heard this one before, but I thought it was kind of interesting. You can either be like a ping pong ball, that if you have a whole box of ping pong balls and you let them all go, they're all just, you know, rolling really quickly, just going willy-nilly. So that's meaning that you're not coping. You're just going with things and you have no way to manage it. Or he said, again, I've never heard this before, but an analogy of if you take 50 frogs and you put them in a vat of cream, the frogs that aren't coping frogs, that are just panicking, they try to swim around a little bit and they stop and they drown in the cream. But there's one frog in there who just keeps going because he's a coper. He's just moving his little legs faster and faster and faster. Well, he turns the cream into butter and then he can get out. So are you a ping pong ball or are you this frog?
A butter making frog.
A butter making frog. And for those of us who eat a lot of butter, probably don't want that image. So really at the end of the episode, Dr. Rick Hansen broke it down into 4 steps. So it does not have to be a complicated process of really thinking about what to do when you're avoiding something, but really to make it a more simple process is first, identify what you are doing. What are the costs and benefits? How do I feel? What am I experiencing? So again, let's say it's by avoiding doing my dishes. Well, I don't have to stand here in the kitchen right now. I can go watch Netflix instead. But really identify, what are you doing? Next is to identify the other way, the other thing that you could be doing. Like, I could wash my dishes right now. And then to really, again, go through, what are the costs and benefits of doing that? Well, if I get it done now, then my kitchen's going to be clean and it will be easier for me to cook tomorrow. Mm-hmm. The cost of it is I can't hear Netflix if I'm running the water, so I might miss my show for a half an hour, something like that. But again, you're just seeing the two sides. Here's what happens if I avoid it. Here's what happens if I approach it. Then make a choice. There's no moral judgment on this. Just make a choice because now you have the information on both sides. And then once you make that choice, if you're making the choice to do the activity, Now imagine what it will actually be like. Do that mental rehearsal. Imagine what it will feel like. Imagine how you will respond. Imagine if there are obstacles, how you'll handle it. So just kind of walking through, identify what are you doing right now as far as the avoidance. Identify the other option of non-avoidance. Make a choice one way or the other. And then imagine actually doing it. Because our brain responds better once it has this mental map. Mm-hmm. So go ahead. Think about it. When I do this, it's going to feel so good. Like I said about my example, I just started thinking about, oh my gosh, it would be so nice to feel good and go to bed at a reasonable hour. Because normally I'm up until the middle of the night packing and doing things. So again, overall, just not pathologizing ourselves for our avoidance. These are normal responses, but recognizing there's a root cause to it. And the more we can keep digging down and identifying how is this coping strategy of avoidance serving me and how is it not serving me? And based on that ratio, do I want to make a different choice? Is it worth it to me to do something that maybe is uncomfortable right now rather than avoid it and experience discomfort even longer by prolonging it? So I think it's just a helpful way for me to keep thinking about this procrastination and self-sabotage stuff that I do. And I hope other people can take some of it as well.
That's very interesting. There are a couple of things I noted as you were talking. And one of the things that jumped out to me was when you were talking about asking what the function was of the avoidance and the behavior associated with that. And you mentioned that it could be protective. Mm-hmm. And it just reminded me of the IFS work that I did when I was seeing that counselor. And that was something really beneficial that I took away from that experience, was that all of our behaviors, all of these habits, all of these things that we've done over the years, especially when we start thinking of them as problematic, if you start thinking of them as being protective, you know, IFS goes into, you know, you imagine characters in your mind for all these different behaviors. But basically, they are protectors. You know, they formed to protect you from a really uncomfortable, painful experience. So, you know, that's thinking back to the root cause, something that happened, was happening, that was painful and that you wanted to avoid it. And so you learned, you built this habit around it to protect yourself from it. And I think once you start seeing all these things in that light, it's a lot easier to start digging into it. Like you said a bit later on, this joining the defense, it becomes a lot easier. And when you were talking about relaxing into the fear and letting it flow through you, it all becomes a lot easier to dig into when you take a step back or multiple steps back and become a spectator where you're not judging. So if your automatic assumption is, if you go into it thinking, right, okay, I accept that these behaviors, I've set them up to protect myself from some kind of painful emotion. So that straight away sort of takes out the, at least some of the judgment from it, takes out some of these, like you were saying, you know, you don't start piling in on yourself and berating yourself. Mm-hmm. And just observe it. And as you were talking about, letting it flow through you and approaching it with curiosity and not with judgment, with the intention of learning something from it, because that is much more likely to go on to be productive in some way.
Absolutely. I love that you covered that. I think unfortunately, what we often want to do is avoid that uncomfortable feeling. Mm. And the way you just talked about it, and actually, Rick Hansen talked about this in another part of this episode. He talked about, you know, sometimes creating a little distance from something helps us see it differently and actually need to avoid it less, mm. that it actually can help us connect with it. The example I thought of when he was talking about that was social media. You know, you see people on social media all the time, like, I'm taking a 24-hour break or I'm taking a 7-day break. But by distancing a little bit and observing, they could get more connected to their lives mm. and more connected to things. And based on what you just described, I think sometimes we cut ourselves off from ourselves because we're so fearful about those feelings or wanting to avoid having that negative feeling versus observing it as it goes through us without attaching to it and holding on tightly to it, I think is an important skill for all of us to work on.
Yes, and it's perfectly understandable, isn't it? I mean, the terms that are used in IFS is exile, is this painful emotion, and protectors, there are loads of other terms as well, but basically, yes, this protective bubble with this exile. And that sort of sums it up quite well, I think. You want to exile that painful emotion or anything that reminds you of that. You want to exile it. And so you build all these protective layers around it. And that's, you know, that's where it gets really interesting, is looking at what these layers are. You know, they can be behaviors, they can be physical things. Like, you know, I learned that the fat that I gained was a protective, mm-hmm. a literal protective barrier. And it wasn't until a lot of it went that I felt very vulnerable and exposed and, you know, explored that. So I think we build all sorts of protective layers. The other thing that I wanted to just touch on quickly was when you were talking about the bodily sensations and how they could be a cue for setting up this avoidance cascade. And it just made me think of Kelly McGonigal's work, in particular back to that episode when she talked about movement and how she reframed potentially negative associations you'd had with different sensations. The reason I thought of it was because you highlighted increased heart rate, increased breath rate. And she took that from being something negative into thinking about it in a positive way. You know, when I start getting a bit out of breath, when my heart rate goes up, that means, you know, it's something exciting. You know, I'm mm-hmm. working out and it's a good thing, and attaching positive associations with it. So I'm sure there's something that can, it feels like a point in the process where you could sort of jump in and potentially start changing some of those associations.
Absolutely. And it's kind of like interrupting. Our brain is so wired to respond to those sensations. Mm. And if we can switch them up, we don't have to keep going down that pathway of being overwhelmed or reliving the difficult stressor. We can actually shake ourselves out of that. Another topic you talked about, shaking.
Yeah. Oh gosh, yes, I'd forgotten that one. Yeah, so lots of helpful things to think about, as I said at the beginning, and as we've both discussed, and you've certainly given some illustrations from your own life. It's something that we both struggle with quite often mm-hmm. in our own lives. So, but there's definitely some things, some really useful things that you've given me to think about. And yes, maybe sit down and explore a bit more next time I'm procrastinating about something, which I'm sure will happen probably in the next 24 hours.
I was going to say, I won't have to wait very long for that to be the case.
So thanks. Thanks very much for that. I've got my notes and I will start applying them very soon.
That's great, Daisy. Well, I hope everyone has a great week and I look forward to our next episode.
Have a wonderful week.